Welcome to the Tattooed Buddha Podcast. Join the dialogue at www.thetattooedbuddha.com. Today's episode features Dana Gornal, Brent Oliver, and Daniel Sharpenberg. The subject, meditation retreats.
Welcome to the Tattooed Buddha Podcast, everyone. There's a Zen story I really like, and it's really short. And it is a student goes in to see his teacher, and the student says, "Master, I'm feeling very discouraged lately. I don't know what to do. I just feel really discouraged. What should I do?" And the master pauses for a moment, and then he says, "Go encourage others." To me, that's a message that means a lot. I know in my life, when I felt discouraged, it's definitely been encouraging others, not just in Buddhism, but really in life in general. Encouraging others has really been helpful to me. So that's a famous story I really like. What do you think?
I mean, I think it kind of fits in with the entire motif of, you know, later Buddhism. I think you practice primarily in a Zen school, which, you know, is Mahayana, which relies pretty heavily on the whole Bodhisattva ideal. And I think that kind of encompasses that in a really down-to-earth, practical, non-mystical way. You know, it's not talking about going out and doing amazing deeds or being some kind of superhero. It's just saying that when you help others, you help yourself in numerous different ways, which I think sums up the whole thing.
So I'd like to hear about your retreat, Brent. I don't know if you can tell us a little bit about why you decided to go on this retreat and how long it was and what your experiences were.
Sure. I am currently training in Shinzen Young's Unified Mindfulness System to become a teacher. I've completed the first leg of three. That was several months ago. And the second leg starts at the end of this month and goes for about 12 weeks. And then the third and final leg starts next year, and it's a year-long program. I work full-time as a bartender, and then I work part-time as a writer and part-time as a mindfulness coach. And my personal teacher, my mentor, has suggested that to become a better teacher, I need more retreat time. You know, daily practice isn't generally enough for us householders. So I was hoping to do a retreat with Shenzhen this year at the end of the year, but the only one I could possibly get to was in Niagara Falls, Canada, and it proved to be just too expensive to get up there. So I went to this retreat through a place called Tri-State Dharma in Cincinnati, Ohio. I've gone to two of their three-day retreats before, and this was a week-long retreat, my first week-long, and they have enough of a sangha that they can actually offer small scholarships to people who can't afford to go otherwise. So they help foot the bill for the overall cost of the retreat, which, huge thanks to them. Otherwise, I would not have been able to attend at all. And it was in Indiana, so it was only about 3.5 hours of a drive from my house, so it was easy to get to. That was pretty much the reasoning behind why I felt I needed to go. My teacher felt I needed to go. I need more experience in this area. And this was the easiest one to get to. It was a Vipassana retreat, so it kind of falls in line with my main mode of practice. And I looked up the teacher who was going to be teaching, and she's been teaching for about 20 years. She has a lot of experience in a lot of different lineages. I was very excited to work with her. And yeah, it was just, it was the closest. It was the easiest. It was the only one I could find before the end of this year that I could manage to get in, and I was able to get the time off work. So it was the primary reasons. As far as experiences, everybody sat down the first night, and the teacher asked everyone to go around and say their name, where they were from, and what their intention was for the retreat. And everyone was saying fairly typical things. You know, I'd like to reconnect with my practice. I'd like to open up to be more kind, fairly normal things that any of us could probably relate to. But when it got to me, I said my name and where I was from, and I said, my intention for this retreat is exactly the same as every single time I sit down to meditate. Total liberation. And there was kind of a rustle through the room, and I couldn't tell if it was approving or condemning. And I found out later from the teacher and a couple of other people, they said, you know, we're really excited that you said that. It's not something that gets talked about very much in American sanghas. I said, well, you know, I was just being honest. I wasn't trying to shake things up. This is what I'm here for. And then I realized through the retreat, I think I may actually be enlightenment proof. After 7 solid days of sitting, I had no experiences that seemed anything other than completely typical when I'm usually sitting on my cushion. Boredom, physical discomfort, worrying that I was wasting my time, all of the typical stuff that I think most of us who have been on retreat have probably gone through. But afterwards, once I got home and talked to a few of my friends, they kind of pointed out that that's a valuable experience in and of itself in letting go of expectations. I mean, obviously, it was really silly of me to expect anything at all when going on retreat. It's not like planning a drive. It's not like you can plan for traffic, but other than that, you'll be there within the given time. This shit is a little more complex and under the table than that. So I think it really helped me with my equanimity in dealing with the idea that I feel like I should be getting somewhere specific. My practice is just going to unfold as it unfolds. I didn't really feel that very well during the retreat, but now that I've had half a week or so to reflect on it, I'm pretty comfortable with the fact that I failed miserably at everything I set out to do for the retreat.
You know, it's interesting because I think, I don't know about what Daniel's experienced or what John's experienced, but I've always read in books and other things where people go on this retreat and they have this, you know, amazing experience and they understand something for the first time. They understand themselves better, you know, something like that. So that's interesting that you didn't really feel like any of that happened.
Yeah. And that I think is sort of what I was looking for. I didn't really go into it with the expectation of something earth shattering happening. My mentor and I were talking and she kind of pointed out that I'm at a place in practice, both time-wise and experience-wise, where sustained practice like this over the course of 7 days could easily produce some of the negative stuff that a lot of people go through. You know, the really feeling the sense of no self or impermanence or suffering and really being thrown up against that in a really visceral, obvious way. And I was kind of prepared for that. I was prepared to be uncomfortable. I was prepared for some kind of sensory or emotional event, whether it was going to be pleasant or unpleasant, and then nothing happened at all. And that I think is where the disappointment came from. I wasn't looking for a magnificent experience. I was just looking for some indication that my practice was progressing to a deep level, and I didn't get that. But one of the things John said, his little text popped up and said that, you know, it's awesome that you were asked about your intention. Intention is the linchpin of practice. And that's absolutely the case. You know, I went in with the intention of kind of forcing myself into a deeper place. And despite that, that's not at all what happened. Now that I'm back, I realize my intention is still the same. I've simply loosened up on my expectations. But yeah, you know, we've all heard about people, especially people that go on 10-day retreats, who say the first day was boring, the second day was weird, and then the third, fourth, and six days, those were all torture. But then toward the end of the retreat, they really settled down and started to have some really pleasant or intense things happen to them. And at the end, they're like, it was totally worth it. The first 5 or 6 days were nothing, but the last 3 or 4, oh, I just connected to something. Something really happened. And I was like, well, now bullshit. If am I the only person that this isn't going to happen to? Because at the end of the retreat, everybody else was, you know, several people cried when we finally broke silence and were allowed to talk and talked about how connected they felt to everyone in the room and the magical experiences they had. And I was just all sullen and depressed over in the corner going, well, failure again. Fantastic.
What do you think, Daniel? Have you ever had that happen?
So I've never done a 7-day retreat. The longest I've done is 4 days. And I've had more 2-day retreats than I can count, but I don't know. I don't know that 2-day retreats generate a whole lot of insight really. But when I went on a 4-day retreat, I did experience that negative. Felt like I was trapped. I felt like, man, I got to get out of here. And then When it was almost over, then I felt a level of calm like they talk about. But at the same time, I'm not sure it brought me any insights, really. I think of retreats as having really several functions. One is away and you're not hurting anyone because you're away on a retreat. I think in the Zen tradition, we talk about vowing to save all beings. And what we're really talking about, I think, is I'm going to save all beings from me. That is, I'm not a superhero. I can't save everyone, but I can hopefully make myself less harmful. And I think on a retreat, since you're away, you can't cause any harm in the world. And then I think another function is it's like a vacation. It takes you out of your routine and shakes you up a little bit. What I see around most of the time is people go on retreats so they can meet the famous teacher or meet maybe a D-level teacher, D-level fame teacher, but they're trying to be around somebody that they think is special, and that's why they're willing to pay. Some retreats are as much as $2,000 because they think they're seeing a special person, and maybe they think in some traditions they think important rituals are being done too. That sort of function is kind of problematic to me. But then the last and the most important function of a retreat, I think, is it just makes you slow down. It makes you put space between what is your regular life and your practice. It makes you put a lot of space between it. And I think that's really helpful. I've noticed just in regular daily meditation at home, it's a good idea to not look at my phone for a while before the meditation and for a while after too, because I think it's just sort of, we're so connected these days that sort of whatever's happening in my Facebook or in my email is going to intrude on my meditation. And retreats are kind of a massive scale for that. It's a massive scale for separating yourself from your phone, from anyone that wants to talk to you, or whatever the daily requirements of your life are. And I think, to me, that's the main purpose of a retreat. I do know people that have done 10-day Vipassana retreats where they just watch recordings of an old teacher who has passed away, and they just watch these recordings and they just practice the whole time for 10 days. And they say those are really incredible. I don't know. I'm a parent. I can't imagine being able to go away for 10 days. I can't even begin to imagine how that would logistically work for me. So I can't even imagine doing that. On the whole, I think retreat centers are really financially motivated, and that's not necessarily bad. I mean, retreats are expensive to put on, and as Brent described, a lot of them do offer scholarships, but I just want to make sure that when people go on retreats, they're going with their intent established and that they're really not there just to be around the famous teacher, because I find that to be problematic.
I think there's definitely a lot of larger centers that have retreats that cost a lot more money, but I don't think I've ever really ran across any who are specifically profit oriented in that they are looking to acquire a better center or more stuff or status. But then most of the retreats I've ever been on are with smaller, more local sanghas. And I know Tri-State Dharma, the people that put on this retreat, they've been around for 30 years and not that many people have heard of them. They don't have a ton of money, but they've been working together for so long that they have enough money coming in to do stuff like, I mean, they've had Lee Brazington as one of their teachers, who is a huge voice in the modern Vipassana world. I don't think they have the Jack Kornfields and the Sharon Salzbergs and the Joseph Goldsteins, but they have enough draw to bring in really serious teachers. And every retreat I've been on with them, the practitioners are very serious. No one is there to meet a teacher because they've heard of them or they really want to brush up against them. One of the motifs that keeps coming up that every teacher I've seen at Tri-State has always said is they've commented on the seriousness of the Sangha and the practitioners. And I think that was something huge that I got out of the retreat, was being in a room full of 17 or 18 other people who were just as dedicated to doing this as I was. Nobody left the retreat. Nobody fled in fear. Most people sat almost every single sitting, every single day. There were never any mishaps with noble silence. You know, there wasn't any, nobody ever pulled out their phones. These people were there to do the work. And that's really been my only experience on retreats, is that level of commitment. And I know the other stuff is out there. I know there's ones that are a lot more laid back, where people can kind of socialize a little bit more throughout the retreat. But I've never been to anything like that.
I don't know. I've never been to a retreat. The closest thing I've ever been to anything like that was, you know, like a yoga workshop. And even that was just like a couple hours. To be honest with you, I can't imagine sitting all day meditating. I think the longest I've ever meditated so far was maybe 20 minutes. And that was at like a meditation group that I went to. You know, at home by myself, it's on average 10, if I can get through that. So I can't imagine sitting all day. I guess I would feel, first of all, like, and this is probably not the thing to say on a Tattoo Buddha podcast, but I feel like I would be wasting my day.
That's pretty common.
And that would be like in my head all the time, like, oh my God, I've got so many things I have to do. And here I'm just sitting here. And then I think that would just be constantly on my mind. I mean, how did you get through thoughts like that?
Because I don't have shit to do. My wife and I don't have any children. We both work in the service industry. I let all of the people that I'm helping guide with mindfulness instructions know that I was going to be out of town for 7 or 8 days. I got the time off from my primary job, and then I didn't have anything writing wise that was due, except for the review of Single White Monk, which I forgot until 11 o'clock at night, the night before I left. So managed to get that one done. But other than that, yeah, I don't. And I think there's probably some difference as well in my intention to become a full-time teacher. That motivation helps deepen the time I'm willing to give to my practice. Because it's not just practice, it's study as well. So I didn't have kids to worry about, whether they were okay, whether they were doing all right in school, whether they were getting to soccer practice or racquetball practice or horseshoes practice, whatever kids do these days. I have no idea. I didn't have anything at all to worry about except being there and doing the work. Several times it flitted through. This is the longest my wife and I had ever gone without talking. She's been on a couple of long vacations with her mom that were a couple of weeks long, but we Skyped several times and we talked on the phone several times. So this was, you know, I said goodbye on Friday morning and I did not speak with her at all until the next Friday evening.
How did she handle that, being away from you that long?
I think she was okay. I mean, we missed each other quite a bit, and our routines are so intertwined. You know, she goes to work at a certain time, several days a week. I go at different times, and we know when each other are coming and going. We know when we're going to cross paths, even though we don't get to spend a lot of time together. And just having that, my half of the routine completely absent, I'm sure was pretty jarring. But she seems to have gotten through it all right. I don't think she was curled up in a ball crying every night because I was gone. But that was definitely the main thing that was on my mind, was, you know, when something like that flitted through, it was, you know, I'm going to have to do this many more times. And that means leaving the rest of my life for 7 days at a time, 10 days at a time. So I don't have, like, you know, you said you would be that, you know, I'm not getting anything done. I'm just wasting my time. I guess my main concerns are more, can my life and all of my relationships support me being able to do this as often as I need to do it? And considering the cost of retreats and the cost of the trainings that I'm doing, I probably won't be able to do another retreat until the end of next year, even if I can do it then. The financial impediments are pretty large. But I totally understand, you know, and that's part of the reason that in American sanghas, the vast majority of people are retirement age, white, upper middle class people who are either at the end of their careers or are already done, because they're the ones who have the disposable income and the lack of responsibility to be able to come and do stuff like this. I'm sure there were a few parents at this retreat, but I don't think there were very many.
So do you think that it's less accessible to the average person then?
For the most part, 20-somethings, if they have a professional level job in, you know, something where they go to a desk and have benefits and paid time off and stuff like that, I think it can be a little bit easier, you know, especially if you have a week or a couple weeks of vacation built up every year. Being in the service industry, I have no paid time off and no benefits. So I can have pretty much as much time off as I want, as long as I find people to work my shifts. But not only am I spending money to go do something on those days off, but I'm not earning any money through sick leave or paid time off, anything at all. I think it's really hard for people. I think it's much harder for people with families than it is for someone like me. I think it's harder to have a family than it is to be poor and do stuff like this, because there are scholarships out there for a lot of places, but there's no daycare. You know, it's not like you can go for a 7-day retreat and say, well, you know, I'll be in the meditation hall and sleeping underneath the meditation hall, and my kids will be a few hundred yards away being taken care of by somebody. They don't have anything like that. So I think it's hard for various groups, but I don't think it would be much harder for anybody than parents. And especially, I mean, obviously single parents, that's monstrously difficult, but even parents who are paired off, what partner is going to be thrilled with the idea of their teammate leaving for a week or 10 days and leaving them with all the responsibilities for however many kids are involved? You know, that's got to be extremely difficult as well. So right. There's a lot of talk about commitment in American sanghas and about how we're soft and we don't have the wherewithal of, you know, the folks in Asia who kind of brought these over here and helped shape the face of Buddhism as it came from there to here. But it's been in their cultures for so much longer. It's had time to affect so much more of their entire just daily life, milieu, everything. And here it's still relatively new and it's not very common. I can't imagine many corporate bosses are used to hearing someone come and say, well, you know, I need 2 weeks off this year instead of 1 week, because 1 week I'll be sitting silently in a room full of other people also sitting silently. And I'd also like a week of vacation. You know, that's the other thing. If you only get a week of vacation and you choose to spend it doing this, I can't imagine that a spouse or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a partner would be particularly happy about that if they're not involved as well. So
your wife is not Buddhist. I'm taking it.
No, she doesn't really seem to need the practice. She's one of the few people I've ran into that just really seems okay on her own. And, you know, it's the harder you push with anyone, oh, you should really try meditation. Oh, I want to just come and do it once. Maybe you'll like it. You know, the more they tend to dig in their heels and resist. So it's out there if she's ever interested. But I think it's enough. It's far above and beyond that she supports me to the extent that she does, that I'm outlaying so much money to do these trainings and these retreats, and it takes up so much time. And we don't have a lot of time off together. And some of those times I'm meeting with my teacher or meeting with a student or studying. And now, well, when I start this second leg of the Unified Mindfulness Teacher Training Program, every Saturday from 3 o'clock until almost 5 o'clock, I'll be meeting with a small group and a teacher via Skype or Zoom. I'm not sure how we're doing it yet. So if she happens to be off Saturday until like 5 o'clock, you know, that's part of our day together gone. So, and then the third round, the final leg of teaching, requires 3 trips to LA in a year. So That's in addition to whatever time I spend studying and meeting with people at home, there's 3 times that I'll be gone for at least 3 days, I would imagine, maybe more. So her support is absolutely invaluable. I couldn't do this by myself. And I don't know if I could do it with another person who is a dedicated practitioner as well, because then we'd both be struggling to find a time that we could both do this, especially if we wanted to go on retreat, unless we wanted to go on retreat together. And then, you know, we've got somebody got to come over and feed the cat. And sometimes we both work at the same restaurant, so they lose two employees at the same time. And it's just, it sounds like nothing but stumbling blocks. It doesn't sound like it's joyful or a practice that makes me better at all. We're kind of focusing on what makes it difficult, but I wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for the practice. And I certainly wouldn't have the small level of sanity I've managed to scrape together without it. Daniel, I know you and John have mentioned at least a couple times in chats we've had on Messenger that, not that you look down on retreats, but I think maybe at least John and perhaps the both of you kind of maybe don't see the value in retreat as much as maybe mainstream Buddhist seems to feel it's a integral part of practice. How do you feel about that?
Fundamentally, my practice is about being in the world, and I'm not always sure when I go on retreats that I'm learning lessons that help with being in the world. So sometimes I meditate at a Buddhist center that is next to a fire station, and that has really taught me that being able to practice with distractions is good, because sometimes fire trucks leave that fire station and we hear it the whole time. So I think I'm not sure that retreats have been that helpful to me, but more importantly, I have noticed a lot of people on the Buddhist internet who will really cast aspersion on you if you haven't done a bunch of retreats. I hear people talk about 90-day retreats, and I just think, really? 90 days? Like you said about the vacation time from work, that's really important to a lot of Americans. A lot of people hardly get any vacation time at all, and it's especially hard to justify if you have a family. I'm going to use my vacation time to go sit in a little room by myself, or sit in a little room, and we're all going to be quiet, and hopefully this will help me be a better person. And I'm not sure, I'm just not sure it always does, but I think the most important thing is to really think about the motivation. I don't like that people go on meditation retreats because they're told they're supposed to. I want people to want to do it if they're doing it, especially if they think that they're at a point in their practice that they really need it. I think that is when it's really important. I think there might be some really financially well-off people who can go on retreats all the time, and they're just doing it because they're told they're supposed to, or they're just doing it as a vacation. And I think that's the wrong way to look at it. We need to be going at it to really try to have breakthroughs, I think, especially if there are aspects of our practice that we're really struggling with.
Yeah.
I think that is where retreats really help. So if you're a person who during your meditation, always your legs start to hurt and they're really distracting after 10 minutes or so, well, if you just force yourself into a situation where you got to meditate all day, you're going to get through that and figure out how to sit in order to be comfortable for a whole sit. And I think that sort of thing is really helpful. And especially, I think a lot of people do struggle with checking their phones, turning on Netflix, petting the cat if it comes into the room, things like that. And retreats are really good for avoiding all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Just the regular distractions, yeah. especially if you struggle a whole lot with those things. That's where I think retreats really can do a lot for us. And the other thing is, I do think everybody should do at least one retreat for a few days, just because it really tells you how dependent you are on the things that distract you. And it really lets you know what your weaknesses are, because once you're trying to do it for a whole day, you really see a lot of things come up that maybe when you're meditating for half an hour, you don't realize that these things are back there in the back of your mind. But when you meditate for a whole day or two whole days, you really start to experience what a crazy person you are.
Yeah. Well, it's so safe. Even if you meditate for an hour a day, no matter the intensity of the experience you have at home on your cushion, your cell phone's still there. You know, the Netflix are still there. The internet is still there. So no matter how crazy it gets for that hour on the cushion, you can always go up and go do your regular shit, your normal day. And that's taken away from you on retreat. You know, most of the people on this retreat surrendered their cell phones, and the teacher put them all in manila envelopes and took them away. I kept mine because it's my alarm clock. I kept it in airplane mode for a week. I didn't miss that at all. I didn't miss Netflix at all. I didn't miss the internet at all. My intention, at least, was high enough that I was dedicated that none of that bother me. I like being able to get away from that. But I think one of the things you said about how, you know, your intention, and obviously Zen backs you up on this, you know, your intention is to practice and to be in the world, you know, not to be off in a forest or off in a monastery. I don't think that changes anything about the actual nature of retreat practice. I think most of us who go on longer retreats go on them not to get away from things in any sort of permanent fashion, but in order to be able to focus specifically on the practice that allows us to be better human beings in daily life and then bring back an even larger dose of that. I mean, obviously it was harder to integrate into the world, back into the world after a 7-day retreat. You know, when I turned on my phone, I was terrified of the deluge of emails and texts and voicemails that were kind of pouring through after 7 days of no contact whatsoever. But once I got over that, I didn't want to go out to a bar and hang out with a bunch of people and jump right back into some kind of social scene. But I have noticed, you know, it hasn't even been a week yet. I've noticed that there are still residual effects from the retreat. And I know they will evaporate over time without that level of practice. But I think retreat really prepares us to be better in the world. Obviously, our daily practice in the world is the main thing. But I think if once a year people have time to go on a 5 or 7 day retreat, I think that really arms them with a much wider array of tools for dealing with daily life for a longer period of time. Dana, what do you think? If you had the chance to go on maybe a 3-day, like beginner level, less intense retreat, would you be at all interested in participating?
No. I don't know. That might be unfair to say. Honestly, Daniel's laughing at me.
Well, it's just pure honesty. That's my response. No, Helen, I'm not doing that. Are you kidding me?
You answered really fast, and that's why I laughed. Sorry.
So I realize that we're all at different levels here, and I'm probably like way down here, and you guys are like way up here. So that's a lot of it. You know, the like I said, the longest I've gone is like 20 minutes, and I'm not even sure it was actually a full 20 minutes, to be totally honest, because we went to this, it was at a library, it's like a meditation group, and, you know, I just thought I'd try it, and it was cool. But, you know, it was like when the guy said that we were going to meditate for like 20 minutes, I'm like, wow, I haven't gone past 10 yet. I don't know how I'm going to do this. So that alone, I think I would need to do a lot more of those. The kind of like, you know, like training for a marathon type thing. Like, you know, you'd right. have to go out and probably run a couple parks before you do a marathon. Well, first of all, being away from my phone would be scary for me just because I have a hard time even just leaving my kids for, I don't mean like my kids aren't little, but I have a hard time going out of town and leaving them behind without constantly worrying something's going to go wrong. And it does. That's the thing. Yeah, like things do go wrong. So it's not like it's just out of left field. It's happened. So I'd always be worried about that. And I don't know if I could get my mind off that. And then I'm definitely 100% addicted to the internet. I'm, you know, I'll admit it. Totally addicted. You know, it's just, it's my safety net. You know, when I'm in an uncomfortable situation or I'm standing in line at the grocery store or I'm trying to avoid somebody, I just pick up my phone and I look at my phone and I, you know, and people leave me alone. So it's my safety net. So all of those things would basically, I would be terrified to be without a phone and to be with my own thoughts for longer than 20 minutes.
Is that something you have any interest in building toward? Not necessarily the idea of a retreat, but the idea of a more lengthy daily practice where you're doing maybe 20 or 30 minutes a day and slowly. Well, I guess the better question would be, do you have any interest or do you see any need in getting further from your phone and the internet? Or are you perfectly content with the way things are like that?
I definitely would like to be able to meditate longer. So, I mean, if I didn't, I think I wouldn't be interested in doing it at all. So there's definitely an interest there. Like I want to be able to do it. I'm very easily distracted. It's kind of a joke. Like, for example, my brother, this happened like about a month ago. My brother texted me to ask me to bring something up to my dad who was in the hospital for a procedure. And I think we texted three or four lines down and I asked him, hey, did you hear dad was in the hospital? And he goes, are you high? Which I wasn't. I mean, that just shows how flighty I can be and how distracted I am. I mean, that's a perfect example of it. So to be able to focus better, I think would be good. So yes, I guess this is a roundabout answer to your question. But yes, I would like to be better at it. I just don't know if I have as much commitment as like you or Daniel or Ty or Strib or anybody else out there in Tattoo Buddha land has. That makes sense.
Yeah. Well, you have a ton going on as well. I mean, not that Daniel and Strib and Ty do not, but you know, I should be the most devout practitioner of everyone because I have the fewest responsibilities, and yet I'm lazy and I'm a slacker, and modern life is so full of warm, fuzzy distractions and ways to pull you away from yourself and your thoughts and your worries that it's around every single corner. I don't think I could live like a monk, but a 7-day retreat with no TV or phone or internet didn't bother me at all. I don't know if it would start to bother me if I did it more frequently, but at this point, I enjoy being away from all that. And it sounds like you definitely would not at all enjoy being away from all that. You
know? Was that retreat primarily self-directed, or was it primarily receiving teachings and then meditating on those teachings?
It was self-directed to the point that we didn't usually have someone in the meditation hall to wrangle us in and make sure that everyone was there and sitting. The participants were in charge of ringing the bell at the end of the sitting sessions. There was no bell rung at the beginning of the sitting session. The schedule was posted. We knew exactly what the schedule was for each of the 7 days. And you either showed up in the meditation hall on time or you didn't. And everybody showed up on time, settled in, and then 30 or 45 minutes later, depending on the length of the session, someone would ring, who's the person with the clock would ring the bell. You're done. But then we got at least two teachings per day from the teacher who was leading the retreat. So there was one later in the morning, and then there was a much longer Dharma talk at night at about 7:30 after dinner and after the last meditation sitting. So we were in charge of wrangling ourselves, but there was instruction twice a day, every day.
I hear sometimes about people just doing a retreat by themselves. And I wonder if you, and I just call that camping, but I wonder if you think that's viable as a retreat as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I know a lot of the writers and the participants in the Tattooed Buddha kind of feel that they're nomads or on the fringes, teacherless, sanghaless, and content or even happier practicing by themselves. I'm happier practicing at home by myself because I'm not a joiner, but I recognize in myself the need to have someone who is much more experienced on the path help me when I get myself into trouble, which is frequently. I think solo retreats, even if it's just camping. I'm an indoorsman. The idea of camping is horrifying. But any kind of solo retreat, whether you are single and live alone and say, you know, I'm not going out of the house for 2 days, I'm going to meditate and eat and that's it, or you go camping for 3 days and do the same thing, I think that has the exact same benefit as going on a 2 or 3 day retreat with other people. You know, there's a different feeling when you're surrounded with other people. Sometimes you could be more, that keeps you more honest because you can't just get up and wander away if you feel like you're having a bad time. But yeah, I like the idea of solo retreats.
I think you said something that it kind of struck me. Daniel made a face too, and I don't know if it struck you too, Daniel, but when you said that you're not a joiner, that rings true for me about a lot of stuff. And that's one of the reasons why I tend to shy away from groups, from, you know, any type of group practice of anything. And I think that's one of the reasons why I would avoid a retreat too. What do you think, Daniel?
I think I was going to say, one of the benefits of practicing with a group, either in a temple service or a meditation group or on a retreat, is If you get up to leave or you check your phone during a meditation or whatever, it's embarrassing. And I think embarrassment is a motivator for people, and people stay on the cushion longer if they're surrounded by other people than if they're just sitting by themselves. So in that sense, I do think group practice is a motivator, just because it's really awkward if you're the only person that gets up and leaves.
Okay, John's talking. Can anyone go into the history of retreats, how they came about as a response, and then his thing disappeared, so I didn't catch the rest of that.
I didn't see the bottom of it, but how they came up as a response to the weather was the last sentence that I saw. Yeah, the original retreats, when the Buddha started his Sangha 2,600 years ago, the monks didn't typically do retreats throughout the year. They went on a 3-month retreat once a year during the monsoon season, because the rains made it almost impossible for them to move from place to place in India as they normally did, and sit out in the woods or in the open or in rudimentary shelter. So the Buddha had it set up with a lot of his benefactors who donated places for them to stay, many different places throughout India during the rainy season. So all the monks were generally cooped up together for 3 months out of the year doing what we would these days typically call retreat practice. But for most of the rest of the year, they were just wandering loose and not all together in the same direction. They would go wherever. I think the Buddha said it one time, everyone head out and no two go in the same direction. I don't remember how I phrased it, but yeah, the original retreats were in response to the climate of India.
Yeah, we tend to think this is important to our practice and these are the reasons why. And we don't really think often about, well, how did this start? And I think now, to a certain extent, retreats are used just to make lay people feel like monks for a little while. So we can tell ourselves we're serious about the practice rather than to try to gain insights and whatever else we're trying to do. I think a lot of people use it as to prove to themselves they're serious about the practice, but it did initially come because it had to be that way. To relate it to the Bible, the ancient Jewish people didn't eat pork because pork was not healthy, was really dangerous back then, and they made it a rule in the Bible, and then it was just carried forth as a rule, even though the reason that it existed wasn't really there anymore. That's what I've heard anyway. I'm not a Bible scholar, but that's what I've heard about why pork is in the Bible as something you shouldn't eat. And I think that's sort of the same thing. It started because of weather, and then we just do it either because it's always been this way or because we think we're going to get grand insights or jumpstart our practice. And those are fine reasons to do it, but I think looking at context is really helpful too.
John says history is cool. I wonder, you know, obviously we don't have any real insight into what they did during those, you know, rainy season retreats, but I wonder if it was used the way we use them now. I wonder if they were taught that this was a chance to really deepen their practice and really connect more with what they were doing, or if it was just unstructured, more like do what you would normally do. It's just everybody has to stay inside because it's a flood out there.
Thanks for listening to the Tattooed Buddha podcast. Until we meet again, feel free to join the dialogue at www.thetattooedbuddha.com.